As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations throwback presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My interview with Ricky Bird first aired Friday, January the 5th, 2018. Ricky was a guitar player for 10 years, 1981 to 1991, in the Blackhearts, and backed Joan Jett both on album and out on the road. From there, he went on to play with the likes of Roger Daltrey and Ian Hunter, as well as pursue a solo career. For 30-plus years, he's been in long-term recovery for drug and alcohol abuse, and we talk about his work and performing at recovery centers, especially how it relates to people impacted by opioid addiction. A number of those songs are on his solo album at the time called Clean Getaway, which is also the name of his nonprofit. Clean Getaway features our then-coolest song of the week, Kicks. That's a version of the Paul Revere and the Raiders hit that Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote. We'll hear some of that now, and then I'll be back with Ricky for your Coolest Conversations throwback presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. And today we are having our coolest conversations with guitarist Ricky Bird, who from the early 80s, early 90s was in the Blackhearts, Joan Jett's band, then played with Roger Daltrey, has had numerous other projects and also been pursuing a solo career. How are you, Ricky?
I'm doing swell, man. It's a cold day in New York City, but I'm very pleased to talk to you. And before we talk about the record, let me just say that you're like an old friend to me, because my car radio is locked into the Underground Garage. So if I'm there alone, you're on. But if I got my 16-year-old daughter in the car, there's a discrepancy of which station to listen to.
Well, first of all, thank you for letting me be the little man in your radio. It gets cramped in there. And secondly, I have a daughter as well, so I can definitely sympathize with that. Although I have to say, for whatever reason, no prodding on my part doesn't help. You know, it digs in the heels. But she's really into the 50s on 5 channel right now. She's like 15. So I'm really surprised by that. Usually it's just... I like popular music, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we swing between the MC5 and Beyonce.
Well, that's a cool swing set, man.
It's always a struggle for the dial in my car, you know.
Well, this week's coolest song in the world is your version of Kicks, and that's a song Paul Revere and the Raiders had a hit with in the 60s on the new album Clean Getaway. So tell us what this album is about and what it means to you.
Well, the Reader's Digest version, I guess, is me personally. I've been in long-term recovery for 30-plus years now after an 18-year run of death-defying leaps of stupidity and near-death experiences. But so recovery, you know, that's my life, right? I'm a clean and sober guy, and I started doing, part of recovery in general is if you're lucky enough to be saved from that lifestyle, is part of the cost of that is reaching back and helping somebody else that's kind of caught between that hallway between denial and surrender, as I like to call it, and try to bring them into a different world where you don't have to use to get through the day. And I do that naturally, just being in recovery. But then I started doing these events, all kinds of rock and roll recovery events, whether it's like for a nonprofit treatment facility or this and that. And I started to get into contact with so many parents that have lost kids to what's going on now in this opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, a lot of people that were fans of mine from and stuff that I've done coming over to me going, man, I grew up on your music, or at this point it's like my grandfather grew up on your music. And it's so cool to see that you're clean and you still have you still got rock and roll in your blood and you're having a good time. So that kind of pushed me forward. And then I did this event about 4 years ago for this organization that is all family members of people that have passed from this. And it was in Washington. It was a beautiful September day. We were outdoors. I put together an all-star band. And so I get to the hotel. I come down for sound check, and the elevator door opens. And the lobby, dude, is filled with people wearing T-shirts with their relatives that have died from this epidemic. And I just, my jaw just dropped, right? So I spent about an hour talking to these parents, and I just said, I got to do more. I just got to do more. So I found a way to combine my music and recovery, and I started going into these treatment facilities around the country. It started out on the East Coast. Word started to spread, and now I've been to Seattle. I've been to Florida, and I go in and I do these hour-long recovery music groups to the ladies and gents that are there for one reason or another. And so I put together a collection of songs which are on this record, and every time I do one of these things, they would come over to me and they'd say, where do I get this music, man? How can I take this home? I need to get this home. So I kept procrastinating for about a year, and I finally said, I got to do a record. So I did one of those campaigns, those online campaigns the kids are crazy about today. And I raised the money, and I did this cool record. And I'm getting, the main reason for the record is now when I go into these treatment facilities, I bring a box of them and I give them out to the clients, which is terrific for me. And the response I'm getting from them on, like the Amazon reviews and everything, people are just really, they're identifying with the lyrics, and they're just getting a lot out of it, which as a songwriter is magnificent. And as a guy in recovery, it's beyond magnificent. So hopefully in my way, music heals, so maybe I could help a little bit. And that was the reason to do the record in the first place, but I'm selling it to the general public. I like to think of this record as kind of like a self-help book with a rock and roll backbeat.
Oh, cool.
I'm selling it to the general public because there's 25 million people in recovery in this country alone. Part of the money that I make from the record, I'm putting into this nonprofit I have called Clean Getaway, which is cleangetaway.nyc. And this year coming up, we're going to do outreach programs that deal with education and awareness and prevention, all based around, all surrounded by music, whether it's an all-star band or me on an acoustic or something. And so that's what I spend most of my time doing. This is my lot in life now, and I'm damn happy about it.
Well, can you mention the name of the website address again? Was it cleangetaway.what?
It's cleangetaway.nyc.
All right.
And you could see in the All-Star Band, if you go to live, like I'm collecting my famous rock and roll friends around the country. So let's say I go to Austin, my dream is to get a tour bus that says Have Recovery, Will Travel on it. You know what I mean? and go from town to town and do these like outreach events. And, this record is for people that are in recovery. It's for, so, you know, people that are in recovery could see how far they've come from the lyrics. And it's not a dour record. I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff on it, too. And also, for people that are struggling, you'll get something out of it. And for people that just love the rock and roll, you know, the main thing is it's a rock and roll record. But what I was saying is, if I go to, like, let's say Austin, you know, I'll call up my pal, like Bobby Whitlock from Derek and the Dominoes. He lives in Austin. Or, you know, there's other people who want to say, look, I'm doing this thing at a school. You want to come and play some songs off the record with me? Or, you know, and I could do that in L.A. You know, I got pals over there, including your colleague, Michael DeBar. Who's a friend of mine. And we'll talk about that, too. And that's what I want to do in 2018, you know, just go around and try to help some. I mean, once you actually seeing it on the news and seeing the commercials and actually talking to parents, or if you know somebody in your family that didn't make it, and this is not your grandfather's drugs, bro. This is like, we're into a whole new thing right now.
You know, the track Kicks that you covered, Barry Mann, Cynthia Wilde song. And by the way, I wanted to say about them that they're my favorite Real Building songwriters. I feel like they wrote them rocking stuff, The Shape of Things to Come, We Got to Get Out of This Place. You know, I know that Kicks was first offered to the Animals, and they passed on it because doing an anti-drug song that I thought was so uncool. But Paul Revere and the Raiders did it. And, you know, it's always a weird thing where I feel like because of their stage outfits, because of like doing a song like that back in the 60s, there was a whole set of folks that were, that sort of solidified them as not being a cool thing. But to me, the song is, you know, it's timeless, right? And why did you seek that song out to cover?
So, being a guy that's been in the music business for a while, I said, okay, I got this kind of concept record. I mean, it's not really a Ricky Bird solo record per se, even though it's you know, it is. It gave me the freedom to jump around genres. So there's like some R&B stuff on there. There's like straight up rock and roll. There's like beautiful acoustic stuff. Which, you know, if you're doing a solo record, that's like, you know, that's like a no-no, like jumping around for most people. So I got to do that, and then I said to myself, all right, so it's a concept record, it's about, you know, addiction, recovery, hope, you know, possibilities. I want to get some airplay on it, so I need to do one cool cover song. And I swear to God, I'm sitting in the car and listening to you guys, and Kicks comes on, and I just went, oh yeah, the first anti-drug song of the 60s. And besides, it's got the greatest guitar riff going, right?
Yeah.
And so I just went in, and funny enough, I went in and I cut it. It was about halfway through recording the record, and I cut it exactly pretty much the blueprint of Paul Revere. And then I took it home and listened to the mixes, and I went, I'm kind of bored. So I went back in and I wiped all the guitars, and I got rid of the 12 string, and I kind of just did it my way, you know, my kind of drunken sailor rock and roll way. And I did, you know, for the guitar players that are listening, I kind of did the riff where I kind of bent up like in a Jeff Becky kind of way. Like I didn't hit any notes true. So you hear it kind of like, meow, 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 you know, and I double it with slide, and, you know, getting rid of the 12 string really took that 60s thing out of it. And I added a little bit of, you mentioned Shapes of Things. I added a little Yardbirds riff at the end, just because it's my record. And it sounds great in my earbuds.
It is sounding cool. So the title track in the album, Clean Getaway, on that song, you sing about being 13 when you tasted your first high. So, wow, 13, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know what's the guy's name, Jim Carroll or something, but did you... Was that what were you using then? What?
Well, at the beginning, it was, you know, I was smoking pot, man. It was like, 71-ish. So it was like most teenagers, you're inquisitive, you're experimenting. You read a lot about what your heroes are doing in tabloids, rock magazines. And you're behind the schoolyard, and you're doing what you're doing. And but not everybody has the addiction gene, so to speak. And I do, right? Because I'm compulsive, dude. I'm compulsive and obsessive, being in recovery 30 years. Like, if I see a guitar, or a shirt on some ad, I can't stop thinking about it until I either get it or, you know, dispose of it in my mind.
Were you playing music at that time? At 13?
Oh, I've been playing since I'm 9. Actually, my guitar, my original acoustic that my mom brought me home after I saw the Rolling Stones on the Ed Sullivan Show, which I talked about in the induction speech at the Rock Hall, that's in the Rock Hall now. And interestingly enough, I had it all these years, and it was in my studio in my basement, and my whole basement got destroyed in Hurricane Sandy, and the top of the guitar peeled off pretty much. But I gave it to them like that, and I said, you know what? In a weird way, it's got like a Townsend vibe to it now. It's beat to hell.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah, I've been playing since I'm 9, and I swear to God, when I saw Keith Richards on the Ed Sullivan Show, and this is right out of my speech, that first of all, they looked like I felt. Second of all, the girls were screaming. And the thing that really impressed this 9-year-old, even at that age, was Ed Sullivan looked completely horrified. And I was like, I'm in.
Well, you know, we first started chatting here. I mentioned you being in the Black Hearts for around 11 years. And, you know, Joan Jett still at it, putting out records and cool ones. But you were there for the best-known songs, beginning with I Love Rock and Roll. And I'm sure you've told the story many times. But can you recount once more for us how you landed the gig with her?
So let's see. I was the fast version is that I was in a band called Susan on RCA. We did one record, and we crossed the country. My first tour, believe it or not, was Susan opened up for Graham Parker and the Rumors. So that was a good start. Squeezing out the Sparks tour. I remember, dude. We were in LA, man, and we were staying at the Tropicana. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
The Tropicana Hotel is probably long gone, right?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at the pool in a leather jacket, of course, in 85 degrees. And I swear to God, I turned to my left, and Marianne Faithfull was sitting like two chairs over reading a book of poetry. And then I look up, and Tom Waits comes walking out dressed completely in black from the bungalows. And I just was like, oh, this is rock and roll. This is it. You know? So that was my first tour. Then I came home back to New York. And I did a little thing with G.E. Smith. I went out with him on a tour for his solo record. And then I, believe it or not, Steve Marriott. I grew up on Humble Pie. Was like one of my favorite bands, along with the Faces and the Stones. Steve was in New York, and he was being managed by Lieber Krebs. My wife was a publicist at Lieber Krebs. We got to be really good friends. We got to be really good friends, me and Steve. Mm-hmm. That was a problem, too. About 86, Steve looked at me when I was getting high, and he said, you better cut down on that, man. And I thought that was really a bad sign.
Yeah.
But that's an inside joke. Steve was known to, you know, he overplayed his hand every once in a while.
Right, right. But, he was living in Atlanta for a long while.
Yes, that's right. He lived there for a while, too.
Yeah.
But we were writing together. We were playing together. And then John Waite left the Babies. He came to New York. Somebody hooked us up. So we were hanging out writing. And then Carol called me one day and said, this girl Joan Jett is looking for a guitar player. You want to go down and you know, play with her? So I said, yeah, sure. And I just went down, and we got along great. And that was it. So part of I Love Rock and Roll record was already recorded with Eric Amble, who's a great guy, great guitar player, really great producer. He left the band, and we basically re-recorded the whole record, except Eric's guitar is on, I think it's on Crimson, it's on Little Drummer Boy, it's still on a couple of things.
Yeah, things like two tracks he's still on, yeah.
Yeah. And we did that record, and it was just like out of a movie, man. We were like on the road. You know, I think we were in a Winnebago or something, and the record comes out, and it all of a sudden hits the charts, and we'd get these reports, right? They say, oh yeah, it's 100 and whatever, and then it's 87, and then it's 57, and then it's 42, and then all of a sudden, like, we're getting a tour bus. It's like, oh, that's cool, and the gig started to get bigger, and then all of a sudden, it's number one, and it's crazy. So we had that, right out of a dream sequence as a 13-year-old kid, you know, a 9-year-old in the Bronx, which is where I grew up, like your pal Manitoba, Bronx boy, you know, who knew, as my grandmother used to say, right?
Right. Well, out of all those albums that you played on with her, is there one that you think doesn't get a fair shake, or one that you think is really great that never got, you know, as much notoriety as you thought it deserved?
Huh, that's a good question. The one, Good Music was, I mean, personally, to record it, I could close my eyes now and see us in the studio with the Beach Boys surrounding me and, like, you know, Al Jardine giving me the note to sing. You know, I mean, that was pretty crazy. Yeah, and I remember the guitar player...
Bruce Johnston, right?
Bruce, yeah, he sat down and showed me the riff to Fun, Fun, Fun. And, I mean, that was a pretty cool record. Darlene sang on that, Darlene Love. You know, there's stuff that probably could have got more airplay, but then once we got involved with... what's his name? We did Little Liar, Hate Myself for Loving. You know, there was like I Love Rock and Roll, and then we kind of did a couple of records in between, and then we got into that late 80s stuff where we had Little Liar and Hate Myself, and then we had a couple of hits with that. And that was cool, too. That was like pretty much a different band at that point. We had Tommy Price and Kasim Sultan in the band. That was a great period, too. You know, there were songs. There's a lot of stuff that didn't get a lot of airplay that probably could have. But, hey, man, I'm not complaining. We had a great run, dude.
Well, speaking of really cool tunes, I want to mention some other tracks on Clean Getaway. You got this Chuck Berry-ish, I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To. That's really cool. It's very soul-feeling.
I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To.
Right, that very soul-feeling Lighthouse song.
Yeah.
One of my faves is Paranoid. Reminds me of a hippie roommate I had from years back. You know, the guy that tells you how laid back he is. you know, it's not. But the one I want us to take a listen to is I'm Done. And when I first heard that, I had to think, you know, how many times were you saying that to yourself?
Yes. So I could tell you right off the bat that most of the subject matter on this record came from me doing these recovery music groups. We would, you know, I'd play a couple of songs, and then I'd say, you know, anybody have any comments, questions? And they would talk about relapse, you know, oh, I've been here, like, this is my sixth time here. So from that, I wrote Addict's Prayer. I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To. I was in a car going to like a support group thingy, and I was on the phone with somebody. Say, man, 30 years, you still do that? You still go to those things? And I said, yeah. She said, why? I said, because I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To. And the songwriter guy in my brain just said, oh, that's a title.
Yeah.
I wrote that down. But I'm Done was the classic. That's the thing, right? And that's the tricky part of getting clean, because when you're in the when your back's against the wall and you're, you know, coming off a run, the logical thing is, that's it, I'm never doing this again, I'm done. And what happens is, once you start feeling better physically, if you've got that kind of disease gene of addiction, substance abuse disorder, this voice starts telling you, you know what, maybe it wasn't so bad, I'll do it differently this time, I'll just do one. Yeah, I've even got that in a song, I think in Highwire maybe. So that's a common, you know, that's a common phrase, you know, I'm done. And that's like the rally cry of every drug addict and alcoholic after a bad night or a bad couple of days.
Well, Ricky, thanks again for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Man, I appreciate it. I'm really happy this record's going to get some airplay. I hope it helps.
Oh, it will, I'm sure. Let's take a listen now to I'm Done off Clean Getaway. Here's Ricky Bird in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Standing at the corner, waiting on the man. Down to my very last $20, got to get me to the promised land. My demons got me scraping bottom, cocaine's telling lies. Whiskey ain't gonna fix me, I'm going downtown one last time. Poison running through my veins, knocking at death's door. But if I live through one more night, I'm getting off this killing floor. Then I'm done, I'm done. Cross my heart and hope not to die. Living down in dirty where the sun don't shine. I'm done.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.